No Direction and Paizo team up to bring you the Gen Con 2018 seminar coverage. No Direction would like to thank our advertising sponsor, the Roll for Combat Starfinder Actual Play Podcast. Listen at rollforcombat.com.
And the internet.
Having
and
a good convention?
Internet, yeah.
Good. This is the Starfinder Rules Q&A. Apparently, we got everything right the first time. No one had to come ask any questions. I'm the Starfinder design lead, Owen K.C. Stevens. To my left,
I'm Joe Piscini, a developer for Starfinder.
And to his left,
and I'm Jason Keeley, also a developer for Starfinder.
So, this is a Q&A. Who's got a question? Nobody. Thanks for coming. Hope you have a good time.
Easiest seminar ever.
Yeah.
So I got one. So my group has a very bad habit. They're very good at min-maxing.
Uh-huh.
And Pathfinder is their favorite for that.
Uh-huh.
Do you guys have anything, speaking as a DM, to counteract that sort of, or how vulnerable do you think Starfinder is to min-maxing, I suppose?
What a great question. I'll lead off. Certainly there are forms of min-maxing.
Repeat the question.
What? Repeat the question. So the question was, Pathfinder is, the gentleman thinks, vulnerable to min-maxing. His min-maxing party loved that system, and he wants to know, A, do we have any advice for that, and B, how vulnerable do we think Starfinder is to min-maxing? I'm going to start with the B part a bit. Certainly there are forms of min-maxing that we saw in Pathfinder that we thought made the game less fun. And we did our best to address those things in Starfinder. One of the reasons that they can be less fun is one of the things that can come from min-maxing is if you conclude the best fighting character is this race, this class, this archetype, this stat array, then anyone who isn't playing that sometimes will feel pressure to be better because they could be a better member of the party than they are, and that means they don't get to play what they get to play. Joe made the point in the previous panel that we really want in Starfinder, if you say, I really want to be a 3-foot-tall rat folk priest who happens to shoot things with a plasma cannon, you can do that and be balanced. So we tried to make sure that there are some natural connections, but for the most part, any combinations of those elements all work well. And that is one of the ways we tried to address the min-max question.
In other words, your party is not your group is not going to enjoy playing Starfinder.
I hope that's not the case.
No, I'm joking.
Do you guys have any input on that?
The character creation, the cap on ability scores, that is unique to Starfinder, correct?
Yeah, talk about that.
There's cap to ability scores of character creation, so you can't start with a score above 18. So you can still get the feeling of min-maxing by saying, I'm going to spend only my 10 points in ability scores in this particular score and choose a species that lets me, but ultimately you're going to be balanced with your other members and with the game too. So,
and at the same time, while it's we assume you mostly use a point-based system. Those points are 1-for-1, and you can lower a stat if you want to, but you don't get any extra points for it. So you can't say my charisma is 2, and that means I get to have a starting strength of 24. That's just not an option.
Yeah, we have minning, but not maxing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that said, there's a lot of you. I mean, I'm a min-maxer at heart, so. You can still get really in the weeds on getting every little specific thing you want, but you don't have to, and I don't know. Not sure where I was going with that.
I think there's a lot of fun, cool moving parts to Starfinder that you can, like as Joe just said, get in the weeds and to really get into for the feel of min-maxing, but when all is said and done, your character's not going to be that much more powerful than someone who didn't do that and just said, oh, I want to play ABC just because that's my character. So yeah, so the balance issue is we've attempted to address it at least.
Looks like we've got a question from Twitter.
Dr. McSpuds asks, are there ways to heal stamina without having an envoy in your party?
Okay, so we were asked, are there ways to heal stamina without having an envoy in your party?
By a doctor, no less.
Yes.
Dr. McSpuds.
Dr. McSpuds wants to know. So the quick and easy answer is yes, take a 10-minute break, spend a resolve, you get all your stamina back.
Yeah.
That said, you guys have any other...
Let's see.
Like if you're in the middle of crashing behind a rock.
If you're in the middle of a fight, is there a way to get more stamina back?
And the way that the system is set up... We certainly want healing stamina in combat to not be universal and common. Stamina represents the effort you're putting out. As opposed to hit points, which is the number of nicks and scrapes and thin cuts across your chest like Kirk from Star Trek you have. So the envoy is sort of already breaking the mold by having the ability to encourage you and drive you forward and bring up your morale and thus restore some stamina. That doesn't mean as the game expands that there won't be yet more options. I think there are a few, and we've
might
got...
be.
Well, and in the real world, there are a lot of stimulants that will like make you faster and keep you going and keep you from passing out. But they don't necessarily mean that you're going to take a punch to the face from a boxing glove any better, which is one of the things the stamina represents. So it is safe to say that we're trying to keep it carefully controlled. Hit points is a different matter. We've got a lot of medical technology, and we've got a lot of magic, and we've got serums, and there are a lot of options for getting hit points back. One of the things that stamina points do is they serve as a street sign that your character is getting to the think carefully, take this seriously stage of an adventure. So we don't want to skew that too badly. Great.
I agree.
I can't think of anything else either.
Yeah.
Off the top of my head.
I am pretty sure we will find that there are one or two thin options in there, and as the game expands, there will probably be more, but it's going to be uncommon, and that's by intent. Do we have more questions? Jason.
Yes.
Come up with a question.
Oh, come up with a question. A
yeah.
Last question, you say.
What's the difference between line of effect and line of sight?
Okay, that's a legitimate question. What is the difference between line of effect and line of sight? Amusingly, we discovered when we were working on the Starfinder role-playing game that Pathfinder does not define line of effect or line of sight, which means you would get into conversations like, if someone is in a cloth sack, can I cast Charm Person on them? And if not, should we all run around in combat in cloth sacks so we're immune to spells? Because gamers can get pretty nitty-gritty on stuff. So line of effect means that I can trace a line from the origin of the effect to the target, be that a person or the center of an area, without hitting any obstacle that would stop that effect. Line of sight means that I can see them. So if they are in a smoke cloud, I do not have line of sight, but smoke does not stop a blaster, so for a blaster I have line of effect. If they're behind a piece of glass or transparent aluminum, I can see them, so I have line of sight, but that thing is going to interfere with the blaster, so I don't have line of effect unless my blaster shot is powerful enough to go through the obstacle, at which point I can create line of effect by breaking through it.
Next rules question. Do lasers go through transparent aluminum?
Do lasers go through transparent aluminum? That's a great rules question.
So now I'm going to point something out here, especially for people who can't see this. Owen is not answering right off the top of his head. He's going to the rule book, which is like the thing you need to do anytime you're trying to figure out a rules thing. Because it's easy to think that you know what, especially we're writing this stuff, so it's really easy to think you know what's in there, but maybe you didn't word it quite the way you thought, or maybe it changed slightly in the multiple person process of getting it into the book. So it's always really good to go back and just read what we actually wrote and put out there.
And I will point out for the people that aren't watching that I didn't bring a rule book. Joe did, so I had to grab his. So there's actually a core principle I want to mention here. A lot of people, when they're picking weapons, they only look at the table of weapons that will tell you its name, level, price, damage, range, etc. But we have descriptions of all those things by category. So laser weapons is its own category. And there are rules specific to lasers in that. And one of the things it says is, these beams can pass through glass and other transparent physical barriers, dealing damage to such barriers as they pass through. So, if I fire a laser at transparent aluminum, it can pass through. It specifically says pass through, but I also get to roll the damage against the transparent aluminum because it heats up as the beam goes through. So there's the answer to that.
It's something to think about for adventures, for sure. Now, hearing it, I knew they were blocked by smoke.
Yeah, well, smoke provides cover.
Provides cover, yeah.
So it's not blocked so much. It looks like we have another question from Twitter.
Thank you for reading these, Lauren. Appreciate it.
So we have a question from Sergeant Drill. How are NPCs so much better than PCs in starship combat? For example, a tier 6 starship with an expert engineer NPC would add 1.5 times your tier plus 9 in engineering or an 18. Not sure how a 6 level PC is supposed to compete with that.
How they're supposed to compete with a plus 9?
Plus 9.
Plus 18.
Plus 18.
Plus 18.
Right, I guess I always get looked at for the Starship Combat stuff because I work on it. But
I have an answer, by the way, if you don't like yours, but go for it.
Well, my answer is why are you looking at me? Because that calculation kind of came in at the last minutes because we didn't tell people how to do it. And we should have told people how to do it, but I was always sort of trying to. I think you might notice that in the pack world, some of the pluses might be lower than they become later. Because I was trying to like just essentially figure out if this were a PC, what stats would they have? And very good, you know, at it. And I think for that particular question, you don't want everyone to have that 9 plus 1.5 level. You want to really more default to the 4 plus 1.5 level. And then the third thing I want to say is that gunnery should not be that high with something we should probably have tweaked or something like that. Because that goes off skills, and gunnery is not a skill. It's just base attack bonus based. Or piloting rank space, which is always going to be at least 3 lower than an actual skill value. But you want to say something, please, Owen?
There are two things to keep in mind. First of all, Starship Combat does not assume that if you are 6 level, you will be facing a tier 6 starship.
That is true.
So the question is not how does a 6 level PC keep up with a tier 6 starship. The question is much more like how does a 6 level PC keep up with a tier 4 starship. We're talking about an expert pilot here. So if I am a 6 level character, mm-hmm. I can easily have 6 ranks, plus 4 from dex, plus 3 for it being a class skill, and plus 3 class focus, just base. And that's a 16. Now, that is below the 19 of someone in my same tier, but we don't assume you're facing someone of the same tier. So one thing is look at an apples-to-apples comparison to what we consider to be a typical fight.
I think you can maybe get that up to 17 if you take the ace pilot theme.
You can take that up, get it up to 17. You absolutely can if you have the ace pilot theme. So we're just too short of someone that's supposed to be higher tier than you anyway. The other answer is the poor GM has to run every role of that starship, whereas the players can all conspire against them, which is a larger brain trust. So frequently, the GM is not going to have the time to come up with his creative solutions, and they're not going to have built the NPCs with things like Ace Pilot, or there are some feats. There are some stuff that can affect Starship Combat. So the only edge they can get to keep up, especially if we're talking about being an expert, is to have a big number. And that means that they can, without having to spend as much time as all 4 of their players combined, or 5 players or whatever, they don't have to take 5 times as long to make a decision. They can just go, well, I'm going to do this thing. It's hard, but I've got a good bonus. So those are why those numbers are what seem to work.
Good answer, Owen.
Thank you.
Thank you for enlightening me as well.
Yes, sir.
So besides the obvious answer of run, do PCs have any, have you guys provided any real recourse for mid-wing tier PCs to deal with a starship coming after them?
Like on the ground? Like, oh, yeah. You're asking how do mid small PCs deal with a starship shooting them while they're on the ground? Run is a good thing.
Run's kind of pointless. If there's a starship coming after you, you cannot outrun it.
Yeah, you really can't outrun it. My advice for that would be why are you doing that to them as a GM? Yeah. It's might be fun to do that, maybe just to throw them off, and you could do it. We've talked about a little bit about. If a starship is shooting at the ground, it can't target a single individual. So I would run that as kind of basically like a hazard. Everyone, start making reflex saves, otherwise you're going to take some damage. And you don't necessarily have to do exactly the 64 times 10 amount of damage that a gun would do, because you're not taking a full blast from it. Maybe this is difficult terrain now because it's getting shot up. So it can be an exciting moment. I would go sparingly on it in terms of in a campaign. Don't do it every time, because then your PCs are going to be like, well, why can't we get in our starship and then just shoot down the dungeon? Just blow the dungeon up. And you won't get all the stuff inside, and maybe there are clues and the story and such.
Joe, you have thoughts?
No, Jason basically paraphrased the sidebar on this very topic in the Coral Book. Which is why we look to him when there are starship questions.
Yes.
So, to answer your question.
No, I know why people did, because I worked on that chapter a lot.
There are 2 other things I would point out. First of all, that's a lot like asking what are Pathfinder's rules for what a mid-level set of PCs should do when an ancient red dragon lich sorcerer attacks them. Right. Run.
Yeah.
The other is, at least in the movies, starships don't shoot at Luke Skywalker. Unless he's in a starship, at which point we've got a set of rules for it. So that's a lot like saying, you know, what does Sergeant Rock do when the battle chute shoots directly at him with its main guns? Run. That is when you've got a military grade vehicle that is somehow targeting a single individual or even a group of four people, someone's going to have a bad day. But it is addressed, as Jason and Joe both said, by a sidebar in the book. And then after that, you're in the realm of, I'm the GM, what narrative thing do I want this to do? How do I want this game to work? And you could even, and he mentioned hazard, you could come up with trap rules even, right? Don't run into the open, you might be spotted by the attack chopper. Okay, great, good to know.
I mean, even capital class weapons, right, on starships can't shoot at tiny or small other starships, so you're not going to get anywhere near picking a group of PCs.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I'm still working through the core rule book PDF, but I didn't think about it until you mentioned starships, targeting ground, people on ground, even if just shooting sporadically at them. I assume there are vehicles in Starfinder on a more small level, and there are probably anti-tank weapons to deal with them. I mean, in theory, could you repurpose something to shoot at a, I guess it depends on how big the ship is. But when I think of like a ship targeting
right. So, asking about anti-tank weapons, essentially, are there such things? Because we do have vehicles, and they have weapons on them, and those are more of a personal PC scale style damage-wise, because you're shooting at, and all those vehicles have hit points and hardness and whatnot.
And provide some amount of cover.
And provide some amount of cover if you're in it for against the shooting, and it's kind of harder to do as you're moving very fast. But that's between vehicles shooting at each other or PCs and vehicles shooting at each other. We don't have a specific starship weapon that is specifically against vehicles, right? We don't have that. I can tell you that much.
Well, we do have the option for a starship to have an anti
personnel. That's true.
Which you could use against a vehicle.
That is true. Yeah, you can. I forgot about that. You can put a normal gun in your starship. You know how like when the docking bay might come down, and then there's like just a rifle just shooting at trespassers, for instance. That can shoot at a vehicle because it's the same scale. It's not as it might not be as debilitating. It's more debilitating against a fleshy thing, being than it is a metal vehicle. But you know, that's something you could do. One thing, but we don't have a specific starship gun that is spend build points so you can shoot at a tank on the ground. Now you could still do it. We try to separate the having the starship rules and the everything else rules. Basically, we try to keep them separate. I think though you could, if you really wanted to, have them have that damage transfer over. I mean, it becomes again what you're doing for a narrative purpose. This is not and that's kind of in a lot of ways how I think a lot about rules is like, how does it affect what you want to do for the story that you want to tell in this situation, and make some stuff up from there.
And in general, right, we say that if for some reason you do need to know the damage that a starship scale weapon does to non-starship scales, multiply it by 10, because we didn't want you rolling 400 dice in starship combat. We do have an armory, for example, as a vehicle, the Hover Artillery, which does 20 D10 damage. So you could go the other way and say, hey, the Hover Artillery is shooting at your starship. I will roll 20 D10, but I'm going to make it 2 D10 because I'm dividing by 10, and then it's 2 D10 starship scale damage. So that is a way that your vehicle could target and affect a starship. And it's got the necessary hit points and hardness that those two could shoot at each other for a bit, but the starship is still probably going to come out on top. It's a starship.
Yeah. I guess in a weird way, all of our starship weapons are anti-tank weapons.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
How does modern armor's environmental protections work against the Solarian's radiation ability? Because one says protects against radiation hazards, and the other one says this is a radiation attack.
Yeah.
Does one count against the other, or is it like two different kinds of things for all radiation?
Okay, while Owen is looking at the book real quick, I will repeat the question. Armor's radiation protection, which at low levels just sort of shields you against low radiation, and then medium and so forth, and grants you a bonus. How does that work against the radiation power of a Solarian? Is that one of the new ones?
No, it's radiation.
I know we have it irradiate the spell as well.
It's a second level Stellar Revelation, and it specifies it emits an aura of low-level radiation. And armor specifies that it affects, I believe, against I know low and possibly low and medium.
And then you get a plus.
Right.
Four
so
medium.
Yes, it explicitly works. So if you've got radiation, you probably don't want to use it against people who have their environmental protection on, although since there's a duration on that, they're only going to have that up so often. And of course, there are a lot of things you're going to run into that aren't wearing armor. So, but yeah, it absolutely applies.
So the power has sort of an inherent drawback in that you wouldn't want to use it against things.
Well, not if they've turned on their environmental protections, but that's an action, right. Yeah. So if they don't know there's a fight coming, if you know there's a fight coming, right, smoke grenades means you want to turn on your environmental protections. But if you don't know there's a fight coming and you want to get all the bad guys to lose an action to turn on their environmental protections, even with people in high-level modern armor, it's worth saying, hey, I'm radioactive. And everyone goes, oh, well, I guess I don't want to glow in the dark. And then they will take an action. And then instead of damaging them, it's an action economy ability. But, you know, if a Kasarik comes at you, that's a different question. Absolutely. Do we have more questions?
I've got one.
Great. Joe, what's your question?
Look at this goofball.
Okay, we're looking at the Bantrid.
Bantrid.
Yeah.
Oh, the Bantrid. How
would you describe this, Jason?
That is one of my babies.
physically, how would you describe it?
A trackball. I know it.
It's a trackball.
A trackball with a cone on top of it.
And we're talking about a species, right, for the people that can't see us. We have a race called Bantrids that are sort of a truncated cone that roll around on a trackball, the bottom of them.
So I could play one of these. This could be my character.
Totally.
Can I use a plasma weapon with this? It doesn't appear to have hands.
Sure. I mean, the question is yes.
Like
the answer is yes to that, because his little fins on the side of his head are his hands, for lack of a better word. And essentially, and I, whether or not we said that anywhere, well, I know I'm pretty sure we ended up saying it later. We're going to be saying it in a future book. But any species that you pick that we say it is a playable race, unless we say otherwise, has the ability to wear whatever it wants to, even if it's boots, like that guy. Can that guy wear boots? Sure he can. It's something else. It's been modified for that creature to fit on the trackball or whatever.
It's a track boot.
And and wields two hands worth of things, unless we say otherwise. Kasathas, Skittermanders, etc. I don't remember if we ended up saying that, spelling it out.
So we did mention it in the armory.
In the introduction
to the armory, we tell you that, you know, there are a lot of non-humanoid aliens with strange morphology, but any playable alien race can use anything in armory, is what we say in armory, but that holds true for the Koru book.
Any equipment.
And any equipment you find, say, like Adventure Path volumes. The intention is that if we say you can play it as a species, then you can use the equipment that's available, even if it says a belt and you don't have a waist.
You can belt it onto something.
Yeah.
And Bantrids, I'll note, do specifically say, near the apex of their torsos, Bantrids have a pair of appendages that resemble large flat hands with several thin fingers. So, can I use a plasma cannon? Yes, with your pair of appendages, with your large flat hands with thin fingers.
We have the Morlamas, which are Technicolor space walruses, and they're described as having surprisingly dexterous flippers.
Yeah.
but even if that little bit is missing from a particular species.
We
can use that stuff.
That's a good point. We discussed it in armory.
It comes up a lot, so I thought
it does.
Plant that question.
And if you don't have one here, but in AP number 5, there's a bunch of new alien races, and one of them is basically a jellyfish. How many hands does that have? If it doesn't have the four-handed trait or six-armed trait or whatever it is, it has two appendages that it uses. It has. So even if it might look like it has more, it only still can hold two hands worth of stuff.
For the same logic that human beings have 10 fingers, but that does not mean I can pull 10 triggers with my 10 fingers and fire 10 guns at the same time.
Right, and the Brathu, the early stage Brathu is another good example.
Yeah.
Lots of tentacles there, playable. You got two hands, basically.
It's a great question, Joe.
And we do talk about armor, too, in that way. We generally say that if I kill Jason...
Hey!
Sorry! And I'm a Barathu, and I want his armor, then I'll have to pay like 10% to get it adjusted.
Yeah.
So it fits my tentacles better and is effective.
But does that 10% also you have to pay if you bought it at the store?
No.
So we say that if it was not designed for your basic size and shape, that you have to pay to have it changed. So if I go to a store that handles Barathu purchases, then they'll have a Barathu suit that I can shove my Barathu tentacles and Barathu brain into, all Barathu-like. If, on the other hand, I am at a Yusoki store, they probably don't have Barathu gear. And that's a place where the GM just gets to decide. I'm reasonably sure on Absalom Station, a Barathu can buy himself a wonderful chapeau-based suit of armor just fine. elsewhere, he would have more difficulty.
It's a big system, and it's got a lot of businesses, and they want to sell, so they probably have lots of custom stuff for any of the even new races that we invoke.
I mean, I'm sure most self-respecting Barathu do bespoke armor anyway,
sure.
But
with a little bow tie.
Do we have another question? Okay. Joe, you want to field that?
I don't.
You don't? Okay. So, internally speaking, we've got guidelines. Those guidelines are based on a lot of experience with Pathfinder and now more experience with Starfinder. There are a few things that we try to stick to make sure that things like the stat arrays work. So every playable race should end up with a total of a +4 bonus to ability scores. That can be +2 to two different ones and -2 to 1.
+2.
+2. Sorry. Or humans have +2 to any one of your choice. Or we've got goblins that have...
Goblins are +4 dex and -2 charisma, which is a net
+2.
Most are +2, +2, -2, right? But that is probably the most important thing.
Right, because that way everyone ends up on the same playing field when it comes to total ability score array. Does that mean we could do a race that is +8 to one ability score and -6 to another? That would probably be a bad idea, which is why these are guidelines rather than a hard set of rules. We also talk about how to convert stuff in the core rulebook if you're wanting to bring legacy races over. There are, again, some guidelines and conversations rather than something like a point-based system. And that is in part to prevent people from min-maxing and saying, well, this race is, again, +8 dex, -6 charisma, and they're all sniper sharpshooters, and no one likes them. that would not necessarily be balanced, even if the numbers came out the same way. Great question, though.
One thing you can do is look at... So for a lot of the... Especially in Alien Archive 1, right, you have some base stat blocks with special abilities and then a playable race sidebar that has a slight variation on that race's abilities. So that can give you a sense of what we thought was a little bit too overpowered for a player character to have. Often it'll just be like, you know, the NPC version can do it all day, every day, as long as they want. The player version might be based on resolve point usage or just X number of times per day per X number of levels or whatever.
And the reason behind that is that if it is something that you guys are going to fight, then its ability, even if it is all day, every day, is actually 2 to 6 rounds, because that's how long it's going to survive. 10 to 20 rounds if the light fight drags on forever. As soon as you tell players, here's an ability you can use all day, every day, then they will do, some of them will do everything in their power to solve all problems by the application of that ability, and it comes up in everything. Yeah, exactly. Well, or if we have given you a whole box full of hammers, then you're trying to find the right hammer to treat this problem with.
Or if your hammer is squirting blood out of your eye like the Akeshti.
Right. then all your problems are things that you want to put eye blood on it.
Yeah.
This analogy has broken down.
Yep. That's my goal with every analogy. Do we have another question? Okay.
Favorite class? It's not a rules question, but it's a great question. Jason, what's your favorite class?
Let's see.
Name all the classes in alphabetical order.
No, I could just do that. My favorite class is the Envoy, even though that is alphabetically first. But still, I think it's my favorite.
Why?
I enjoy buffing. I enjoy helping other players get things done. So Envoy is good at that. Envoy has some fun skills, and every once in a while I'll like to be the party face.
The bard.
Every once in a while.
Joe? Well,
Jason kind of stole every part of my answer.
Oh, shoot.
First.
What's your second favorite class, Joe?
Yeah, so I'll tell you about my second favorite. Because I play, Jason runs a developer game for us, and I play an Envoy in that game, and I enjoy all the things that he said, which is...
Well, then we should play a game together.
Well, yeah. It's also, you know, you get to be a little goofy if you want with the Envoy. We it literally has a class feature called Not in the Face, for instance, or Watch Out, that kind of stuff.
Watch your step.
But, get him.
Yeah, yep.
You shout that in the middle of combat, and it means something.
Right. But I also like the Technomancer a lot. I feel like I can min-max a bit with it. do a lot of damage, magic missile, I mean, come on. But also, you can do interesting utility things by interacting with items. And yeah, just flavor-wise, it's a great marriage of sci-fi and fantasy, which is what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. My favorite class is the Solarian. And it might be because I like the ability of having an energy sword and being able to hurt things with my mind and throw objects and leap great distances, but that's legally distinct from any other science fantasy character role that does those things. But seriously, the Solarian, when we were first looking at writing this book, when we were outlining it, we had the Envoy, and you said Bard, right? So a lot of people are like, well, the Envoy's the space Bard. Great. We had the Soldier, that's clearly a space fighter. We try to make the Technomancer not the space wizard, but they do get magic missile, as we mentioned, so there's sort of that feel. People felt the Mystic was the space cleric. Again, we're trying to be distinct from that, but those roles, it's not difficult to draw these analogies. And Rob McCurry, who's was one of the lead designers with me for the Core Rulebook, is now the creative director, said, what class are we going to do in Starfinder that is new to Starfinder, that expresses what we want Starfinder to be, that is not the space some class we already did in Pathfinder, something that we can say, here's a new thing, this whole galaxy, all these races, something different has happened. And the Solarian, who manipulates fundamental forces of the universe, photons and gravitons, was our answer to that question. And I'm biased. I got to write the first draft of it. So obviously it does stuff I like. I wrote it. But a lot of really smart people came in and did other drafts, and there was developing and there was editing, so there's a bunch of stuff I love in it that other people came up with too. But it is the class, I think, that is the science fantasy class that is least like something I got to do in Pathfinder, that I think fits the Starfinder setting very, very well.
I'll throw in that Mystic, I think we did a good job of making it not space cleric, because the healer Mystic might be space cleric, but your connection as a Mystic dictates a lot about your class, and there are so many different, like, I could even consider them like subclasses. There's so many different cool mystics you could make that I could just make a bunch of characters just making mystics and be happy. So,
and one of the things, again, in the previous panel, Joe mentioned, which I think is important, is that class party makeup is not as critical to get, in air quotes, right in Starfinder as it is in Pathfinder. So, again, for the whole reason we're talking about the stamina, if outside of the fight, it is easy to heal. Inside the fight, if you don't have an Envoy, it's hard, but that's okay. We know that. I have run games that were 5 soldiers, and those soldiers all took different fighting styles and different gear boosts, so they all acted with the environment and fought distinctly from each other. They were different. They were not doing the same thing as the guy next to him, and they were, as a group, effective. Like Joe just said, our connections for mystics are so distinct that it is easy to have a group of 4 mystics, each with a different connection. And the Mindbreaker Mystic and the Akashic Mystic don't feel that similar, especially since they're selecting different spells known. Looks like we have a... I'm sorry, do you have...
I was just going to throw on that even flavor-wise, those mystics could be wildly different.
Yeah,
they're not all necessarily worshipping different gods, but even just completely different.
One could be psychic, and one could have looked into the void too long and discovered ways to manipulate reality, which for some reason is different from psychic. It looks like we've got a question from the internet.
So, Kennedy AG asks, hey panel, what do you think the mechanic is a space version of?
The mechanic is the space...
Repeat the...
Absolutely. Why don't you repeat it?
Kennedy AG, was it? Yeah. Asked, what is the mechanic the space version of?
The mechanic in many ways is the space summoner and or the space ranger. It is our pet class in that you can get a drone... and that allows you to have a secondary character that does stuff with you. But also, in much the same way that rangers interact with nature and things in nature, which is one of the most common environments in Pathfinder, the mechanic is interacting with technology and technological items and technological environments, which is one of the most common environments in Starfinder. So it's sort of ranger is to the dangerous woods where the adventure takes place, as mechanic is to the abandoned mineshaft or robot factory that is where the adventure takes place. Do you guys have thoughts on what you see the mechanic as a link to?
I've always thought of them as the pet class.
Yeah.
In space. But that is, I mean, that is overlooking the, that's just one option as a mechanic. Of course, you have the exocortex option. So
totally.
I'm not sure what that one would track to necessarily, but it certainly makes sense to me from a sci-fi fantasy perspective. Well, especially harder sci-fi, really.
Yeah, as I was saying, that's sort of like the ranger who doesn't take the pet.
Right.
Right.
Basically, and takes a bunch of, you know, archery-style feats.
Right.
And that kind of thing.
And the mechanic is probably the one that is the least like a direct link over after the Solarian. Mm-hmm. Do we have any more questions at the moment? Because we'll make stuff up, I promise. we have a question from the internet.
Internet.
Thank you, Lauren.
So, Stray U asks, will we ever get a class that gets an organic alien pet?
Strayu asks, will we ever get a class that gets an organic alien pet? Joe?
We have not announced anything.
it's not outside the realm of possibility.
Yeah, you know what would be cool is if every class had some kind of option for that. But
it would be cool. Yeah. In Alien Archive 2... we have the Squawks, which is a cute little squirrel fox, which will give you the option to have a pet that you bring around, a mechanic to make sure that pet does not die two levels later because you're two levels higher, and even a way to get a game mechanical benefit from having that pet. Now, that's just dipping our toes in the biological pet arena. And I don't know if we've talked about the Squawks anywhere, but we've announced Alien Archive 2, so I'm on firm ground there. And then we'll sort of see how people react to that and what we want to do with it. But as Joe said, that's something that anyone can pick up. So there's a lot of science fiction and science fantasy out there where the whole crew has a mascot or someone has their one special familiar. Your space pirate sometimes has a space parrot on their shoulder, like, you know, Captain Harlock, space
pirate. With a bubble helmet.
With a bubble helmet,
yeah.
Totally. At least in the 50s. So it's definitely not outside the realm of possibility, but it is something that we would want to approach very carefully. There are questions of stealing the spotlight from the mechanic, if the mechanic has a drone and someone else has exactly the same thing, except it's cute and furry. And then the drone obviously has some significant action economy issues. And one of the reasons that with the drone it doesn't worry us that much is that we say someone can shatter your drone, you can just rebuild it. It's good. But if we give you a combat-relevant pet, if you have a space wolf that can do stuff, and we make it as powerful as the drone, that means that there is a decent chance that it will be torn apart. And living things don't get rebuilt as easy as drones do. So, but at the same time, we wouldn't want to make it more powerful than the drone, because then the mechanic who's been playing with the drone all this time would think, well, why am I bothering to do that? Someone else can do it better. So there's some tricky challenges. That's not to say we can't find solutions to those challenges, but we're absolutely keeping an eye on what interest is and how our first foray into that is received.
Maybe keep it flavored and be non-combat related.
And that's largely what we did with the Squawks. So there are absolutely, I think there's a strong solution is to have good multi-level game mechanical beneficial non-combat pets, and that ticks a lot of those boxes.
That there's a broader issue here. Often when you're asked, thinking about rules, it's important to keep in mind that you're not stepping on the toes of the core classes and kind of the main ideas. I always want like the coolest, most powerful option, but if I get that two levels before the class that's all about that option, then that kind of destroys an entire class just for my one little thing that I want, so...
And one of the things that we're sort of trying to promise when we say that these are the things in the core rule book is that these are the core concepts to the game. So if we do more character classes, we don't want them to be worse than the core, but we don't want groups to say, well, there's no point in having these core classes anymore. Well, that means that they're not core anymore. Same with the races. We've done a lot of new races, but none of them are flat superior to the races that we did in the core rule book. That's also why our legacy races that we mentioned here, the elf, the dwarf, the gnome, you can play those, they're fine, but we're not doing as much support materials with them, they don't show up as often, they are not as integral to the setting. So because they do come from that Pathfinder legacy, we want to tell you how to play them, but we carefully call them out as something other than the core races. So we've got a few minutes left, so if anyone has any questions that they've been saving for the end, is the big dramatic question, now is the time to whip that thing out. Otherwise, having forced both these other guys to come up with a question, I will come up with a question and
I
see how
I actually came up with a question.
Oh, we'll do it.
All right, great. No, that's good.
Why did I say something?
I'm looking at my old list of questions that I had to ask you early on.
That's great.
But
that's actually
it's your turn.
Good.
I don't know, it's going to be like,
what's your favorite color?
No, that's not a good rules question.
That's not a good rules question.
By the rules, what is your favorite color?
What's your favorite color of rules?
Printed.
There you go.
Okay, I got it.
Hey, we got a question.
All right, so with old powerful magic items and the current state of defenses, armor, etc., how obsolete are some of these old things? Like, say, a staff stuffed with fireballs. How obsolete is that in the current?
Fireball is never obsolete.
Yeah. How, the question is, how obsolete are your older magic items and sometimes, I guess, weapons against their new armor? Because we have the archaic quality for certain items which do less damage against characters in modern day armor. But as Owen said, a big ball of fire is always going to hurt people. We have in the first AP just some bunch of relics of Galarian that are old, sort of like, here's this thing from the Thrun family, and here's one of the Swords of Sin, but now it's a chainsaw gun. And
Ungaratu.
Ungaratu. And later on in AP4 you go spoilers a bit to this civilization that has bows and axes and they are all archaic, so they are doing less damage against you, and that is sort of purpose of the story, but they also have enough, they're still doing maybe like 4d10 at a high enough level, which is, 5 off of that is can be a lot, but also if you'd rolled a whole bunch it's still 30 some damage, right? They're not. But that's to sort of make the point, for the purpose of, you just, the bow and arrow, but one of those bows and arrows or one of their axes against something that's not wearing armor still does the same damage, right? So they're not completely obsolete.
We've got a magic helmet in Alien Archive, and we specifically call out, you can adapt this to your powered armor, your modern armor, right? It's a magical helmet. One of the things our armor suits use, in some cases, are environmental fields, too, so that you don't have to have a hard plate over everything. So you can adapt the environmental field to cover your head more so that I can wear the magic helmet and not have to have the big bubble helmet or the heads-up display and still get the benefit of it. If you're going classic, right, weapon is one thing, but a ring of invisibility is a ring of invisibility, right? That's useful kind of regardless. So... okay, so if we don't have any other questions, I think I will go ahead and call it so that people can get to their next set of events early. Do we have any final thoughts, panel, on rules in general?
Rules. Can't live with them, can't play the game without them.
All right. Thank you all for coming. We appreciate it very much. I hope you all have a good Gen Con.
Thank you.
Thank you all.